We now have plenty of time for questions. The cards are, of course, designated to different speakers or the entire panel. The first question is for Ed. What advice do you have for people just starting out in the medical marijuana dispensing business?
There are more dispensaries now than when I was arrested, and there are more dispensaries throughout California than when I was arrested, and more of these dispensaries are working in cooperation with local governments. And my advice would be, if you're going to start a dispensary, to try and make arrangements with the local government. Try to become a officer of the city, although that hasn't helped me much. Dot your I's, cross your T's in terms of business licenses, and try to work with parts of the city government other than the criminal arm. I mean, rather than the criminal justice system. They're not going to give you a hand, but city council members, if there's a public health service in the city or the county, organizations like that within the government will help you. And the other advice that I give is, remember, you're there to serve your citizens and your clients. It's not there for you. You're there for them.
The next question is for Donald Abrams. In the clinical study of cannabis, how were the subjects' immune systems improved? Was this finding statistically significant? Are any researchers looking into this further?
Yeah, good question. The CD4 lymphocytes are the cell that the AIDS virus infects. It's the helper cell of our immune system, and as HIV progresses, the number of these cells decline. The CD8 lymphocytes are the suppressor cytotoxic cells which fight virally infected cells. A high number is associated with people who are the so-called long-term non-progressors. What we saw in the group that smoked marijuana was a very highly statistically significant increase in CD8 cells compared to the placebo group. We also saw a CD4 increase that was significant, but not as highly statistically significant as the CD8 increase. So we saw immune system benefits on both of those parameters. But in a number of other more extensive immune system studies that we did, we saw no real difference between the three groups.
The next question is for Ed Dobb. Mainstream news media typically strive for balance and feel they've done their job if they give equal weight to both sides. Do you see any way to get the mainstream press to do more probing and more real reporting?
Certainly, through this sort of activity. I'm a full-time working journalist, independent, I think by my participation in forums like this, I can have an effect on other writers. I can have some impact on the way issues are framed. I think it's simply a matter of, in terms of writers and editors campaigning for the type of story and the type of the approach to a story that more clearly defines the stakes.
Okay. Question for Rob McCoon. How can we overturn marijuana laws in the U.S. while being a signatory to international drug treaties?
Let me swallow my ice cube first. That's a very good question. Actually, these international treaties are one reason why the Dutch have not legalized marijuana. They've come up with this elaborate way of de facto legalizing it because they're signatories to these international conventions. Now, conventions can be renegotiated. In the early 90s, I went to a European Union conference it was a meeting to harmonize drug policies what harmonizing drug policies meant at that meeting was bring the Dutch in line. And the Dutch were really being bullied at that meeting. Almost a decade later, we see many of the old adversaries of the Dutch in this battle really moving in the Dutch direction. And as Europe is changing, Australia, Canada are changing, I think we're going to see movement internationally that there's this belief in American exceptionalism, and it may well be that America doesn't care, American federal government doesn't care what other countries are doing. But one thing that I think is important is that some of these other ways of dealing with marijuana will no longer just be hypothetical. We'll actually have experience with those, and we find out what happens. And so far, as we're accumulating evidence, we find out that not much happens. The sky does not fall in, and I think that that's potentially important.
Another question for Ed Rosenthal. Where is the tipping point in this drug war?
I think the tipping point has already occurred. And the tipping point was when, as occurred over a period of time, citizens in eight states voted overwhelmingly for medical marijuana. And when we heard in the polls that between 60 and 75% of the population is in favor of it, we've tipped in terms of medical marijuana. And it's just that right now the tail is wagging the dog. It's not going to be happening for long. And one of the things that the book The Tipping Point talks about is that things will go along on a plateau for a while, but when things start happening, they happen quickly. And you know, in our lifetime, that's happened any number of times. One day we woke up and the Soviet Union was no longer. We had apartheid in our country. There are a number of major changes. There was no gambling in this country. You know, there was only one state that had gambling. And now that's an accepted practice. So I think that we have actually tipped, and we're going to see a rapid change in this, probably with the new administration in Washington.
A number of questions, which I'll direct to the entire panel. And this is regarding the question of what do patients or individuals with terminal illness do to alleviate pain and live outside of, who either live in or outside of California. We're talking about people with Crohn's, ALS, and many other ailments. If the feds are breathing down the neck of clubs and so forth, what can these individuals do? Who can they turn to?
Yeah, actually, let me give a non-medical opinion on this, which I think it's extremely hard to justify prosecution of people using marijuana for medical use. But I think we also have to be clear that the evidence is the risk of arrest and prosecution for someone using marijuana medicinally or otherwise is quite small. About the probability of arrest for all marijuana users in a year of using is about 3%. And for medical patients who are using it medically, the risk is certainly lower than that. There are a lot of people in states without medical marijuana laws who are already obtaining marijuana and using it.
Anyone else? Okay. Another question for the entire panel. One of the real concerns of the opponents of medical legalization is the growing use among youth, but medical marijuana is used much more by people who are older. Can you comment on this youth age question?
Actually, I just read, I think yesterday, that as an example of how the current drug war is not working, that there has been an increase in utilization of marijuana smoking in sixth graders and eighth graders or something. This is certainly Marsha Rosenbaum in the audience knows this a lot better than I do, and I just heard her speak. But I think that this question of the gateway drug, I always quote whoever it was that said that marijuana is as much of a gateway drug as caffeine and tobacco. It's just people have access to these things at a younger age, and then if they go on to other things, it's because of that, not because of marijuana leading them to other drugs. So I think there is a problem with use among youth, but I think we need to be upfront and discuss it with children.
Actually, I think that the it's been shown that some of the federal commercials,
are backfiring.
Have totally backfired, that they've actually given kids an incentive to use it. And, there was that one commercial that said that you were the youngest grandparents in the neighborhood.
Right.
I mean, I never found that effective that way, but that might have a certain incentive for youth. And also, I think the taboo factor comes into play. I have a 12-year-old daughter, and she doesn't seem to have an interest in using it. She thinks of it as an adult thing, but I think when you bring the taboo factor into it, that is a major player in it.
May I say something?
Yeah.
I think, too, that obviously the discrepancy between what people actually know by virtue of experience, especially with marijuana, I mean, it's like we're living on two different planets. There's a group of people who've been involved in this social experiment now for the last 40 years, a couple generations, and has accumulated wisdom about the use of marijuana now, and it's completely at odds with what many of policymakers and politicians view. And I think that discrepancy, if it's promoted in terms of education and anti-drug programs, just fosters a cynicism and a disbelief in those very officials, because they're so out of touch with the reality of a drug that's now so widespread on a recreational level that it's for many people, it's just part of the woodwork now. It's part of the climate we live in. And I think that has an erosive effect.
One more thing, from reports in the newspapers, Bush's own daughters don't believe the rhetoric.
I think would be also a question for Dr. Abrams. What research is planned or has been completed about addictive influence of HIV medicines on cannabis users? So, a reverse question.
Addictive influence? I'm not aware. I'm not sure I understand that one at this point.
For the entire panel, the question is, please talk about SB 420 and what it means if it's passed. This is regarding the issue of plant limits for individuals and co-ops and so forth.
Okay, SB 420 is the Vasconcellos bill that we were talking about. And what that bill would do is set a certain minimum for counties, because right now marijuana legalization in California, effectively, medical marijuana legalization is by county by county. In some counties, they say you can grow a large number of plants or possess a large amount. In other counties, it's a very small amount. And this would set certain minimum standards. Counties could adopt other standards, but this would sit at a floor on them. And it's 6 plants and, a certain amount of space. But it also provides for more medical research. And medical marijuana community is really divided on whether this bill should be signed by the governor or not, because Lockyer's office, the Attorney General's office, put such limits on the number of plants that it would be difficult for some patients to grow enough to provide themselves.
Just by way of comparison, in Alaska, there's a state Supreme Court decision that interprets their privacy provision in their constitution as allowing up to 25 plants, not for medical use, but for anyone to grow up to 25 plants. So just to put it into context, how low this limit is.
But, let me get into this for just one moment. Marijuana flowers based on the number of hours of uninterrupted darkness that it has. So you could take a plant that's this tall and flower it, or you could grow a plant for 6 months where it's 12 feet tall or something before flowering it. So plant size is not a real accurate method of describing the volume or the quantity that you're going, or the yield that you're going to get. And there are much better methods using either canopy space or the number of lights. And this is just cop jargon where they say, oh, well, he had 1,000 plants. And, you know, everybody's picturing these giant plants that are 5 feet breadth and 10 feet tall. And the way I was cultivating mother plants, there were in a 3x3 square foot area, there were 24 plants. I mean, they were very small plants. So to use a plant count is really not an accurate method of describing marijuana.
Another question for the entire panel. Do you feel the average recreational pot smoker ultimately helps or hinders the legitimacy of medical marijuana?
I mean, we could interpret that as a question of moral philosophy, as a question of politics. I think from a political perspective, it probably cuts both ways. The existence of recreational users certainly creates the possibility that somebody might be pretending to have a medical condition to get marijuana, and that's always the caricature that's held up. In fact, you know, a third of the American adult population has tried marijuana without a prescription. And so it cuts both ways, because in fact you have so many American adults who've tried marijuana that I think it's shaping their political views. And I think that's one of the reasons why we are only for the first time in several decades starting to see a shift in public opinion about marijuana.
No, but on the other hand, a lot of people who think that they're using marijuana recreationally are actually using it medically, in the same way that a person might come home and have a drink after work as a stress release or as a life enhancement. And in fact, my doctor told me I'm supposed to have 3 glasses of wine a day. Luckily, I don't do that. But there is a lot of use that people might consider recreational, but is actual really either life-enhancing or a medical use?
Another question for Ed. In a Chronicle op-ed piece, you lamented your inability to vote now that you are a felon. Letter responded that you're wrong. You still can vote. Please comment.
That's true. I learned that I was misinformed by my supervisory officer about my voting status, and I do plan to vote.
I hope everyone notices the irony of that. Here you have the jury not informed, making their own decisions. He gets convicted. His parole officer doesn't even know his own rights. Another question for the whole panel. Are there good numbers of the extent of police budgets as they become more and more dependent upon asset forfeiture?
Yeah, if you go to Google and you type in Albany source book on criminal justice statistics, there are actually a lot of, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but you can all look them up for yourself. It turns out that there is increasing database now on this, and you know, just to sum it up qualitatively, it's becoming an important source of income for a lot of agencies, and which of course creates a serious conflict of interest, I think.
Another question for Ed. Do you think it will take a national vote to make marijuana legal?
I think that in order for the Democratic Party to win back the presidency, it has to come out at least in favor of medical marijuana. And you know, you would think that it was a no-brainer for the candidates. Marijuana wins by wider margins than they do.
1932, we got.
Another question is for Don Abrams. These are in reference to different medical issues. One, for example, is, are there studies regarding marijuana and menopause? Do people develop tolerance, either physical or psychological, to the effects of marijuana. Let's see, there's another one here. Are there significant reaction times and motivation to marijuana use? How does that change for different types of people and the degree of usage and so forth?
Well, I don't know of studies that are currently ongoing that are formal in people, women with menopause, but I'm sure menopausal women have their own anecdotal experiences. So I don't know the answer to that. With regards to tolerance, I think I'm not really a substance specialist of in this fashion. I'm a AIDS and cancer doctor, so I don't really know all these details, but I do believe that enzymes get inducted as people smoke, and you might need more or less marijuana depending as time goes on. The other questions I sort of went by me too quick, and I don't have answers to them anyway, so.
Question for Ed Dobb. The recent Supreme Court decision striking down laws against homosexual sex appear to open a window toward protecting privacy and liberty. Do you see an opening regarding drugs cognitive liberty? Do you see an opening regarding drugs cognitive liberty as far as an implication or an effect?
Yeah, in fact, this goes back to a little, if I understand the question, back to that the tipping point question earlier. I obviously take an extreme position in terms of legalization, or at least the cessation of government intrusion into private behavior. I don't foresee a tipping point regarding any of the more serious drugs or the drugs we take more seriously anytime soon, if ever. My deepest concern is that various crises are used, be they related to drugs or not, to expand police powers. And once they are expanded and the crisis is over, whether it's manufactured or manipulated, that it's the police powers are not automatically withdrawn. We sort of take that as a given, and there's a cultural shift going on. In fact, I was thinking as we were talking about gateway drugs, there are gateway steps to intrusion on civil liberties. And that's what concerns me about the overall atmosphere in which we discuss this thing. Obviously, we're not going to legalize cocaine or heroin anytime soon, but I think in our debate about that, we should be very concerned about any change, any expansion in terms of police powers, because then it can be used for anything, not just drug use, but any kind of personal behavior. And I think that's why we're all at risk. We all have a stake in what's happened to Ed, and it's all our responsibility to at least be vigilant and aware and to do what we can to make sure that the state does not expand its police powers.
There's a question for Ed. The Medical Board of California is claiming that Dr. Todd McCurriga, a Berkeley psychiatrist, has violated a quote, standard of care, unquote, in 17 of the 7,500 medical marijuana recommendations. McCurriga notes that all 17 cases involve patients who've been targeted by law enforcement. He claims that state law enforcement officers who oppose Prop 215 are trying to intimidate doctors like him and prevent patients from getting medicinal cannabis. Do you feel this is true?
Well, when they say California Medical Board, it is it's Californian and it's a board, but it's not medical. It's the district. It's out of the district attorney's office, and these 17 cases were complaints not by patients, not by their caregivers, not by their loved ones. Every one of the complaints against Dr. McCurriga is by police officers or prosecutors, and my attitude towards this is that I'm not going to, I promise not to call a doctor if I have a robbery, and they should stay out of the police and the so-called medical board. You know, this medical board is really there to investigate doctor fraud, you know, doctors' fraud or pill pushers and things like that. And the fact that they're using it in this politically motivated thing, it denigrates the entire Attorney General's office. And as a result of this, I call on Lockyer to resign for this. Really. He's too much. He's not in the hands of the people. He's not representing the people. He's representing a small clique of verbal terrorists who are members of the California Narcotics Officers Association.
It's a question for Don Abrams. Any evidence that marijuana or THC can have a beneficial effect on depression?
I mean, you know, again,
like being depressed about the laws.
Clinical trials have really not been done about that. I think there's interesting information about schizophrenia. There are some people believe that schizophrenia may be actually responsive to marijuana, and that some adolescents who have so-called schizoid personalities tend to be ones who use more marijuana. And it's one of these chicken and the egg questions. Are they schizoid because they're smoking marijuana, or are they smoking marijuana because they have this schizotypal, as psychiatrists call it, tendencies? Depression, it's an interesting question for those of us who care for patients who are dying, for whom marijuana can provide many different medical benefits, including relief of pain, increase of appetite. There is also what people who are sort of funny about their opinions about marijuana call the side effect of euphoria. And, you know, is that an adverse side effect for people who are depressed or for people who are dying? I think not. So I think some people actually do get more depressed, though, after smoking marijuana. I know many people in my generation, in fact, claim that they stopped smoking marijuana because it seemed to depress them a bit. But I think a buzzword now in medicine is pharmacogenomics, and it means that we all metabolize drugs differently depending on our genetic makeup. So I think to make a blanket statement about depression and marijuana is not possible, and it probably goes both ways. Pharmacogenomics.
Another question for the entire panel. Please discuss the role of science and law enforcement with respect to possible harm to others from using marijuana, e.g. driving under the influence, and of individual health effects, e.g. possible carcinogenic effects of smoking marijuana that individuals should be informed of.
Yeah, there are several lines of evidence on this question. One is by looking at motor vehicle mortality data, and there is some correlation with marijuana use, but when you look closely at it, it mostly involves cases where the person was also under the influence of alcohol, and the alcohol effect was probably acute. The marijuana effect is less certain because marijuana stays in your bloodstream for up to a week, and they're probably measuring alcohol rather than marijuana. And a more direct way of testing is to put people in, they set up in a parking lot these little driving tests and have people drive under the influence of various substances. And marijuana does impair psychomotor coordination, but that's largely offset by the fact that marijuana users drive more slowly. And before he passed away, the late Pat Paulson, the comedian who ran for president every 4 years, I emailed his campaign headquarters and got a quick response from him because I think he is the campaign staff or was the campaign staff. I asked him, you know, where his office stood on the question of legalization of marijuana. He said, "I'm against it because it makes people drive too slow." And so, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm making a joke, but I don't want to trivialize this. It's not a good idea to operate heavy machinery when you're stoned, obviously. But it exemplifies something that I've seen again and again in pouring through all the research trying to document harms of marijuana. And what I'm struck by is there are tremendous professional rewards for finding harms of marijuana, and there are a lot of people out searching very aggressively. And I see a standard of evidence used that is quite different from the standard of evidence I see in other areas I work in, and I find it quite troubling. I see extremely weak effects getting really trumped up. I see interpretations by NIDA-funded scientists that are not at all supported by their studies. Just as a quick case in point, so-called animal evidence for the gateway effect is extremely indirect. One study that supposedly implicated a link between marijuana and morphine was based on gnawing movements by rats. When they take marijuana and they counted gnawing movements. Something they didn't do, which would have been obvious to do, is simply give rats THC and see if they're more likely to self-administer cocaine or heroin. I can't find any study that's actually done that in the literature. Obviously, that's what you would do if there was a gateway effect. And I have to assume that if you could do it, they would have found it by now. And so, marijuana is not harmless. It's also not as harmful as the government is telling us.
Can I address cancer for a second?
Yeah.
The National Toxicology Program of the Department of Health and Human Services did a study in rats and mice, they delayed the publication of by 2 years until we discovered the draft copy and asked them where the final one was. The study gave rats and mice increasing dosages of delta-9 THC, which is synthetic, the compound that's most psychoactive in marijuana. And what they found was that the rats and mice who got higher dosages actually lived longer and had fewer malignancies. Rats and mice are not people, however. So Steve Sidney, who's a medical school colleague or classmate of mine, and also the director of research for the Kaiser Foundation in Oakland, published in the American Journal of Public Health an overview of men in the Kaiser system who were followed for at least 10 years, divided into four different groups of 5,000 men per group. One group never smoked cigarettes or tobacco. One group smoked only tobacco. One group smoked only marijuana or tobacco. And the other group smoked both. The over 10 years of follow-up of 5,000 men who never smoked either tobacco nor marijuana, there were two cases of lung cancer. In the groups that smoked tobacco, either alone or with marijuana, the risk of lung cancer was increased 13-fold, which is the risk of cigarette smoking. In the group that smoked only marijuana and never tobacco, there were zero cases of lung cancer. Now, zero compared to two, it's a small number, but you can't say anything statistically, but certainly it did not appear to increase the risk of lung cancer. And if we look at Rastafarians in Jamaica, for example, a population that uses marijuana extensively for religious and cultural purposes, there is no increased risk of lung cancer. There have been people who have published studies suggesting that there's increased head and neck cancer, and for unclear reasons, perhaps prostate cancer, but I believe that these studies are probably flawed and there are other cofactors that are accounting for these malignancies.
Another question for the entire panel. Are you familiar with LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition?
Yeah, I just got a t-shirt from them someplace. It's a good one.
Yes, there are police officers who are really concerned with this, that they either they know better or they see their police force being corrupted with it, by it, and pretty much LEAP members are ostracized by the criminal justice community.
If a person is a patient in the hospital and has a medical marijuana prescription or ID card, can they possess and or use their marijuana while in the hospital?
So most hospitals are currently no smoking facilities, and that holds for marijuana. We have at San Francisco General certainly much more extensive use of substances besides marijuana that goes on our campus, but we do have a little courtyard on the third floor of the hospital outdoors where patients do go to smoke cigarettes, and I'm sure that some of my chemotherapy patients have been seen there as well.
One thing is that smoking marijuana is pretty much an artifact of prohibition, and so there are many other ways for marijuana patients to receive it. They can use a tincture, which they use sublingually under the tongue, or brownies, pills, and other ways of vaporizers so people don't have to smoke it. And, you know, for instance, if you're in a, let's say you were in a theater and you wanted to light up, and that would disturb people around you. But if you just had a tincture and you put a few drops under your tongue, no, it would disturb nobody.
Our research is done in San Francisco General Hospital, and to equip the room in the General Clinical Research Center, we had to put a fan in the window that exhausted to the outside. Unfortunately, being San Francisco General Hospital, the door to the patient's room to the hallway is about an inch above the floor, so nurses, when the patients are smoking, have to roll up a blanket and put it outside the patient's door, sort of the reverse of college.
There are a number of questions that relate to one of the points that Ed Dobb made in his presentation, and this relates to the issue of if marijuana were legalized and taxed, couldn't that be a major source of public revenues? And there's different ways of looking at it. One point before I pass it to Ed is that when the Harrison Act was first passed, it was actually an excise tax on opiates. And the tax then created a black market, and to enforce black market contracts, different groups, of course, used draconian means, meaning violent crime rates went up, and the solution to that allegedly was to ban these different substances. There's more to it than just that, but that's essentially what happened. And as Ed also mentioned, the similar kind of thing happened from the 1930s on, as far as when prohibition was lifted on alcohol, that marijuana was taxed and then ultimately banned. So anyway, the question is, what would happen if marijuana were legalized and taxed? Is that anyone?
Well, we take that up in the book Drug War Heresies, I think if we were going to move to some sort of legal model, there are a lot of advantages to a home cultivation model rather than a retail and tax model.
You know, I think of it more as a tomato model. And what I mean by the tomato model is this. Actually, you know, if you're going to grow a vegetable garden, you're most likely to grow tomatoes. And there are more tomatoes grown and eaten and consumed that are grown homegrown than are grown commercially in the United States. But that still leaves a very large commercial tomato market. And I think that for most people aren't going to want to grow their own. They don't have the space or the time, or they just use a little bit, or they use it once in a while. And those people have no incentive to grow their own. They really just want to go and purchase it. And on the other hand, there are a certain number of people who are going to want to do it. Now, there was a book about that covered abortion, the cause. It was called Baseball Abortion and Prohibition, I think. And when abortion became legal, it went down by the cost of an abortion went down by about two-thirds. When alcohol was re-legalized, it went down by about 50%. So if there was a model that was a legalization model that had a certain amount of excise tax in it, the market would absorb it, because people are paying that excise tax in terms of the risk. When you buy if a person buys an ounce of marijuana right now, you're paying a certain amount for the cost of manufacture and distribution and so on, and then you're paying an extra price for the risk that the grower is taking, and the taxes would fall somewhere in between, would take some of that risk money as an excise tax. That's typical. I mean, take cigarettes as an example. There is a certain amount of cigarette smuggling, but the overwhelming majority of cigarettes that are sold in the United States today are taxed.
But I will say, when we took a look at the home cultivation model, it hadn't occurred to me that home cultivation might be addictive, and that does raise some concerns.
I just have a question for one, time for one last question. And this is for the whole panel. And this relates to the point that was mentioned earlier, that all of the major candidates in the recall election have endorsed medical marijuana. What can a new governor of California do to stop the federal campaign against medical marijuana?
Okay, I think that the new governor could come in and start defending, use his state resources to defend medical marijuana users and their suppliers, and say, well, if the federal government is coming in, we're going to defend these people. And I think that the federal government would back off, because they'd never, ever be able to get a conviction again.
If a state politician really started, especially a governor, really started contesting the federal government on this, I think it would be, really be a very serious political consequence for the federal government. And would really risk undermining support for the federal government's position on marijuana. You know, it's striking how few this is truly remarkable that we have all these candidates endorsing medical marijuana. When we wrote our book, we couldn't find any politicians in office to cite as being in favor of marijuana reform other than Mark Morial, the mayor of New Orleans at the time, and Kurt Schmoken, mayor of Baltimore. Otherwise, there were no politicians on record as favoring drug reform of any kind.
I want to thank Ed Rosenthal for his superb work and truly courageous leadership. We're indebted to Ed, and as Ed has said, it's just a matter of time. I also want to thank our speakers, Donald Abrams, Edwin Dobb, and Robert McCoon, for the really excellent presentations and taking the time to join us for this program tonight. We're especially grateful to our co-sponsors, Harper's Magazine, the Drug Policy Alliance, and the Goldman School at UC Berkeley for their marvelous assistance. And most of all, I want to thank each of you for joining with us. Without you, this program wouldn't have been such a success, and the movement that we're discussing cannot possibly succeed. As I mentioned earlier, Ed and Rob will be available in the outer lobby. We hope that each of you will pick up copies of their books. Anyone seriously interested in this issue cannot do any harm, I'd say, at the least. And I strongly encourage you to get their books, and they'd be happy to autograph them for you. Please also visit our website at independent.org for upcoming information about our events. We look forward to seeing you at our next Independent Policy Forum. Thank you and good night.